Chapter 10 Journey's End. I am glad to have Pa enjoy himself in his old age. Julia Cutler. 1. Life for Ephraim Cutler, now in his 70s, had eased off only somewhat. He was serving still as a judge and a trustee of Ohio University, as well as in one effort or another intended to benefit the Ohio way of life. Further, with the help of daughter Julia, he was underway writing his own story. "I have had rather an eventful life," it began with characteristic understatement. Beyond all that, he was taking part with the political activists calling themselves Whigs, those in opposition to the anti-intellectual attitude of the Andrew Jackson administration, including many ministers, lawyers, doctors, and other well-educated Americans. Nor had the social life at the Cutler homestead diminished. If anything, it seemed busier than ever. Virtually all who gathered were known to be admirable talkers, including, most conspicuously, attorney Caleb Emerson, who frequently stayed on as a guest a week or more, discussing the old and the new, and in a way Ephraim's daughter Julia described as most satisfactory to themselves and instructive and delightful to those whose privilege it was to listen. When in the summer of 1843 it became known that former President John Quincy Adams was to make an unprecedented expedition to Cincinnati in November to lay the cornerstone for what may have been the first public observatory in the Western Hemisphere, it was felt that a small committee of Marietta leaders should take part in the occasion. Those chosen for the honor were Ephraim, Joseph Barker, and Caleb Emerson. Excitement in Marietta over the approaching event was like nothing since the visit of Lafayette. Following his defeat by Andrew Jackson in the presidential election of 1828, Adams, as had no president before, returned to Washington as a member of Congress, and there he served still, steadily, relentlessly. He was known as Old Man Eloquent. Short and plump, he had a voice that carried like no other, and he spoke with marked fervor. On receiving the invitation to take part in the occasion at Cincinnati that fall, Adams had accepted without hesitation. Family and friends were gravely concerned that it was too late in the season, not to say too late in life, he was 76, for such a long, difficult, possibly perilous journey. Adams saw it as a heaven-sent opportunity to take advantage of growing popular interest in astronomy and to build backing in Congress for the new Smithsonian Institution, one of his favorite causes. As he wrote in his diary, it was a duty he must fulfill in the cause of learning. "My task is to turn this transient gust of enthusiasm for the science of astronomy at Cincinnati into a permanent and persevering national pursuit, which may extend the bounds of human knowledge and make my country instrumental in elevating the character and improving the condition of man on earth. The hand of God Himself has furnished me this opportunity to do good." His plan was to leave his home in Quincy, Massachusetts, on the 12th of October, accompanied by a servant, Benjamin Andrews, and traveling by railroad, lake steamer, and canals, by way of Buffalo and Cleveland, he hoped to reach Cincinnati on November 6th. As it was, despite what for him was the acute monotony of rail travel, "There is no uniformity in human life more monotonous," he noted privately. Despite snow and howling winds on Lake Erie and seemingly endless days on overcrowded Ohio canal barges, during which he caught a cold, enthusiastic crowds greeted him at every stop, and on November 8th he reached Cincinnati in bright sunshine. A stop at Marietta was planned for his return trip by steamboat on the Ohio, and from there, the Marietta dignitaries would accompany him as far as Pittsburgh, from which he would travel on to Washington by rail. A tremendous crowd had gathered at the Cincinnati Hotel, the Henry House, where Adams was staying, on the front of which was a large balcony overlooking the street. From there, as he would record in his diary, Mayor Henry Evans Spencer delivered a complimentary address, welcomed me to the city, and introduced me to the assembled multitude, who answered by deafening shouts of applause. Adams's answer, he was sorry to have to record, was flat, stale, and unprofitable, without a spark of eloquence or a flash of oratory, confused, incoherent, muddy. And yet, to his amazement, it was received with new shouts of welcome. The crowd then dispersed, but a continual succession of visitors beset his hotel chamber until late into the evening. The laying of the observatory cornerstone was to take place the next day, and though he had been working hard for some time on what was expected to be a long and important speech, he still had not finished. Worn down with fatigue, anxiety, and shame as I was, I sat up till 1 a.m. writing the address, which from utter exhaustion I left unfinished, and retired to a sleepless bed. At 4 o'clock, he woke again and finished what he wanted to say. The speech he had written was a long, nearly 2 hours, he figured, learned and reverential dissertation on the history and importance of astronomy. A printed version would run to no less than 63 pages. But because of unexpected adverse circumstances, he delivered only about half of it. On departure from the hotel by carriage, followed by a parade of other carriages, military companies, and a marching band, all headed for the hilltop where the cornerstone was to be laid, rain began to fall, increasing rapidly to torrents by the time they reached the hilltop. A stage had been erected, from which Adams was to deliver his address, but now he saw a whole plain covered with an auditory of umbrellas instead of faces. His manuscript became so blurred by the rain it was scarcely legible. Cutting his talk short, he finished by saying, "Here would arise one day, lighthouse of the skies." Here they were gathered to lay the foundation of what they could hope would aid in the cause of science and improvement in after ages. The venerable patriot, as he was referred to in the Cincinnati Press, had done his duty, and on departure he left no doubt among the citizens of the city of his admiration for them, indeed of so many he had met in Ohio, who were so naturally frank, easy, and unpretending in their manners, which commend them rapidly and highly to the stranger's estimation. He departed the afternoon of November 12th, heading for Marietta on board a steamboat that, after all the talk and celebration over the subject of science, bore the appropriate name of Benjamin Franklin. Plans and preparations for the Adams visit had been going on at Marietta for months and with increasing enthusiasm. But then, on September 21st, word had come that another of the outstanding, much-beloved early pioneers, Joseph Barker, had died at his home at Wise Man's Bottom at age 78. He had been actively involved in the life of and growth of Marietta from the time he first arrived, more than half a century before, designing and constructing many of the finest buildings, building boats, and serving in numerous ways in times of crisis. Samuel Hildreth, one of Joseph's numerous friends, as well as the Barker family doctor, was to write, "In hospitality, he was unsurpassed, fond of social intercourse, gifted with a ready flow of language, and a mind well stored with historical facts. His conversation was both instructive and interesting." Not the least of his achievements was the lively, colorful account of his life he had written to help Hildreth with the collection of pioneer memoirs Hildreth was at work on, an account that would later be published as a book unto itself. He himself, it would seem, was proudest of all of his large, devoted family. He was the father of 10 children, all of whom were still alive but the one boy who had drowned in the Ohio River years past, and in addition, there was a grand total of 63 grandchildren. His wife, Elizabeth Dana Barker, had died in 1835 at the age of 65. The day following Joseph's death, a long line of carriages carrying family and friends, plus many more on horseback or on foot, comprised the funeral procession to Joseph Barker's final resting place beside his wife in the Putnam Cemetery, not far from the Barker homestead. It was yet another rainy day, Wednesday, November 15th, when at 2 in the afternoon, the Benjamin Franklin came into view downstream on the Ohio. Guns fired. Bells rang. Former President John Quincy Adams had arrived. A great crowd greeted him at the Marietta Wharf, notwithstanding the rain, then followed him to the already crowded Congregational Church where he was to speak. Deacon William Putnam, the son of Rufus Putnam, delivered a warm welcome, and Adams, without notes, stepped to the pulpit, and to no one in the audience did what he said mean more than to Ephraim Cutler. He spoke at the very start of the long connection he and his father, John Adams, had had with the pioneers who first settled at Marietta. He recounted how his father had known and worked with the Reverend Manasseh Cutler. He told how he himself, when studying law in the town of Newburyport, Massachusetts, had visited the Reverend at his home the summer of 1788, just after his return from his own visit to Marietta, and how, ever since that conversation, he himself had taken a deep interest in the whole West and watched its progress step by step to its present great and flourishing condition. He talked also of Rufus Putnam and others besides the Cutlers, and credited much that he knew to accounts that had appeared in the Massachusetts papers at the time. From this source, reported a later account of his talk, Mr. Adams drew the materials of that admirable half-hour's address, and the minuteness of his details, and the correctness of his names, dates, and other statements, proved the amazing accuracy and discipline of his memory. His remarks concluded, Adams left the pulpit, and one by one, the congregation was presented to him. It would have been gratifying to him, he told those clustered about, had the elements allowed them to express their welcome without exposure to such an inclement day, but that so much of the light of human kindness was shown him that the name of Marietta would ever dwell upon my heart. At his request, he was then taken to the Mound Cemetery, which he had first learned about from Manasseh Cutler and desired to inspect. From there he went directly to the boat, where Ephraim Cutler, Caleb Emerson, and Joseph Barker, Jr., substituting for his father, also went on board to accompany Adams to Pittsburgh. Ephraim could not have been more pleased. He had greatly admired Adams for a long time. As his daughter Julia recorded, he had even bought a new overcoat for the occasion. Ephraim and Adams had much in common. They were the same age, 76, and each the son of a famous and gifted father. Both cared intensely about education and equal opportunity. Both were unequivocally against slavery, and both loved to talk, as did famously Caleb Emerson. The conversation among them on the boat went on well into the night and commanded the attention of all who were so fortunate as to be present, and particularly when Ephraim expressed to Adams the gratitude felt by so many in Ohio for the wisdom and firmness his father, John Adams, had shown in the negotiations at the Treaty of Paris in 1783 that secured the Northwest Territory for the United States. As Ephraim wrote later, I saw the tears gather in his eyes. And Caleb Emerson noted that Adams's voice faltered in saying that he rejoiced to find that there were some who still remembered the services of his beloved father. Ephraim further noted, I also gave Mr. Adams a concise history of the convention that formed our state constitution and the consequent exclusion of slavery, he said with emphasis, "Slavery must and will soon have an end." As was well known, Representative Adams had for years been battling against the so-called gag rule used by members of Congress to suppress debate on slavery, and though the struggle had taken its toll on his strength, he had not given up. All along the Ohio River, slavery was a growing cause of contention, and particularly in and about Marietta, which had become one of the main escape routes for runaway slaves in what had become known as the Underground Railroad. Notices appeared constantly in the Marietta paper, offering rewards for black runaways from Virginia for as much as $300 to $500, or as little as $12.50. The $300 reward was for the return to Parkersburg of three slaves named Jack, Rose, and John. Jack is a very handsome Negro, about 5 feet 10 inches high, a black complexion, erect in his appearance, and about 26 years of age, had on, when he absconded, a deep blue bearskin coat, etc. Rose, the wife of Jack, is a likely woman of her age, about 5 feet 6 inches high, black complexion, hair tolerably long and tied at the top, has holes in her ears but seldom wears earrings, and about 36 years of age, had on, when she absconded, a blue riding dress with white glass buttons. John is about 5 feet 7 inches high, very black complexion, thick and well set, had on linen pantaloons, etc. For two others, named Martin and Sam, a full $500 was the offer for their return to Clarksburg. Martin, at age 20, was the youngest, about 5 feet 8 inches and very handsome. Sam, very black and free and easy to talk to. For the return of a black man named Joseph, who claimed to be a doctor and was fond of playing the fiddle, the reward was all of $20, and there were more and more steadily crossing the river to escape. Many in Marietta were helping the fugitives escape, but to make known their part would have been putting themselves and their families at considerable risk. One notable exception was David Putnam, Jr., the great-grandson of General Israel Putnam, and a leading merchant whose large frame house at the head of Maple Street, across the Muskingum and Harmer, became a famous first stop for fleeing slaves. One cold November night, a mob of anti-abolitionists gathered outside the house, shouting that an escaped slave was hiding inside. Several leading citizens appeared on the scene, including Caleb Emerson, and urged everyone to calm down and go home, which was what happened. Others, too, perhaps as many as 50 in Washington County, served as conductors along the line of escape. The rest of the escape route ran north to Oberlin, Ohio, then across Lake Erie to Canada. To what degree Ephraim Cutler took part is difficult to know, but one particular incident suggests he may have been quite involved. Years later, one of his grandsons, Rufus Dawes, the son of Cutler's daughter Sarah, would tell how, as a boy visiting his grandfather's old stone house by the Ohio, he was awakened in the night by what he took to be the hoot of an owl, this followed by a similar, more distant answering cry from the Virginia shore. Then came the splash of a boat leaving the Cutler riverbank. The boy climbed out of bed and went to the window. In the heavy darkness, he could make out the silhouettes of two boats filled with silent people approaching shore in front of the house. When he went to his mother's room, he found her down on her knees before her window, praying. After a magnificent reception on arrival at Pittsburgh, Adams bid farewell to his Marietta escorts and started for Washington while they headed back down the river. Few there were who had traveled more of the world than John Quincy Adams, from the time when, as a 10-year-old boy, He had sailed for France with his father in the midst of the Revolutionary War. This, his journey to Ohio, was the last of his courageous travels. On reaching his home on F Street, Adams collapsed. "My strength is prostrated beyond anything that I ever experienced before." But he was to keep on serving in Congress, battling slavery for 5 more years, until the late winter of 1848, when he collapsed at his desk. He was carried to the Speaker's office just off the hall, and there, 2 days later, he died. In Marietta, a town eulogy for John Quincy Adams was given at the Methodist Church on Putnam Street. 2. It would be said of Ephraim Cutler that along with so many of his strengths, virtues, and worthy accomplishments, his place as the most notable of Ohio's surviving pioneers, he was also blessed in his family. "We have never seen a family that were united by stronger bonds of affection," it was said. And while he took great pleasure and pride in all his children, William, the youngest son, still in his 30s, had stepped in to carry on with his father's public roles and in admirable fashion. William had little of his father's physical vitality and was of retiring disposition. But in 1842, he had begun making speeches in an effort to be elected as a Whig in the state legislature, and though defeated, he ran again in 1844 and won by a handsome majority. Before the close of the session, he was recognized as a leader on the floor. Such achievement pleased his father no end, and helped provide Ephraim a much-needed lift of spirit when, in June of that year, his ever-loving brother Jervis died in Evansville, Indiana, at age 75. Writing to William early in the new year of 1846, Sister Julia could report that Pa's health has been better this winter than it was last. He has fewer cares and appears to enjoy life better. It was their mother she worried about. "Her limbs are very painfully affected with rheumatism. She cannot dress herself without assistance and is unable to do anything. Even reading seems to fatigue her. She sits up most of the day and certainly bears her afflictions with a great deal of patience." That fall, William was again nominated and again elected to the state legislature, and the difficulties of his return to Columbus in December, at least as far as Zanesville, appear to have been no less than in his father's day, and that his response to adversity had been no less than that of his father. As he wrote in a letter to Ephraim, "The stage left Marietta at 11 o'clock Wednesday night, and we had a perilous time getting to Zanesville. We found the water over the bridge this side of Lowell so deep that the driver refused to cross. I prevailed upon him to let me have a horse and ride over and back, after which he ventured with the coach. We drove over Big Run Bridge with the plank all afloat some 8 or 10 inches above the sleepers, the four wheels in some places pushing the planks up in heaps, and the hind wheels running on the sleepers. At another place, we tried to swim, but the horses refused and turned directly for the river at the mouth of the creek. We were barely saved by striking a high bank, which projected into the stream. At the bridge across Olive Green, we found the plank afloat, and the driver and myself waded in and spent half an hour in the water, loading the plank down with stones. But we were graciously preserved and arrived safely at Zanesville Thursday evening and at Columbus, traveling by rail, Friday night." He then added to his father, knowing how it would please him, "The Whigs, with great cordiality and unanimity, have placed me in the Speaker's chair." Later, at the close of the session, a letter appeared in the Cincinnati Signal by another member of the legislature named F. G. Squire that seemed to speak for many and that to Ephraim could only have seemed pure gold. "Let us glance around the hall of the lower house," it began, "not to admire its architectural wonders, and see if we can detect the men of mark. Our attention first rests upon the speaker's chair. Its occupant is a tall, perhaps we should say, sallow man, dressed with the utmost plainness. He stoops slightly. Is it from a sense of being tall and without elegance? No. Although modest and retiring to a fault, he never bestows a thought on outward appearance, nor calculates outward impressions. When Mr. Cutler was called to the Capitol, he came there with a healthy, well-balanced intellect, and nothing but a modesty almost painful in its excess prevented him from at once assuming the lead of his party. Yet without effort, he soon became invested with an influence second to no other man's on the floor, and his voice carried with it a predominating weight. In Marietta, too, Ephraim, as he reported to William, was hearing in a lively manner joy respecting your success. But he cautioned his son with a fatherly reminder, "You must not let flattery spoil you, but do your best to deserve approbation." On June 30, 1846, Sally Parker Cutler, the wife of Ephraim Cutler for 38 years, and mother of their 5 children, died amid the family circle at their home on the banks of the Ohio. As William would later write to Julia, "How little did we anticipate that the center of that circle would be taken, leaving to us but the bright recollection of virtues, unsurpassed, and love unequaled." In the early spring of 1849, Ephraim's oldest son, Charles, announced he was joining the rush to California for gold. A year ago, we had not heard of the gold of California, and even after the papers were filled with descriptions of the immense regions where it is found, and of the multitudes who went to seek it, "it never occurred to me that anyone dear to us would go there," wrote Julia. Again, as in her father's earlier days, the West was the future. 2 months later came word from California that Charles had died of cholera. The news shook the whole family in a way nothing had. To think of his dying away from home and friends, buried upon those vast plains where no one knows even the place of his last rest, Julia wrote. And the blow fell hardest on Ephraim. "He is very much bowed down under the stroke. Still he murmurs not. The language of his heart seems to be, 'I was dumb. I opened not my mouth, because thou, God, didst it.'" Occasionally we hear a suppressed groan as he walks his room with clasped hands. 3. For all the changes taking place, Marietta remained a small town, its population by 1850 still less than 4,000. But for a considerable majority, this remained part of the appeal, and for many of those long-time residents who had played major roles in the local ways, their commitment to the community, their pride in its appearance and way of life, was no less than ever. To the citizenry of Marietta, and particularly the older element, there was considerable pride, too, in the fact that a community established on the precept of freedom of religion had kept faith with that pledge. The first efforts to establish a Catholic place of worship in Marietta were made in 1830 in a 2-story brick building with a grocery store on the first floor and what served as a chapel on the second. The first actual Catholic church was built in the 1850s under the direction of Father Peter Perry, and with the ever-increasing arrival of Irish and German Catholic immigrants, the number of Catholic citizenry kept growing steadily. Among the earliest Jewish immigrants to arrive were 2 German brothers, Charles and Samuel Koblenz, who established a dry goods store on Green Street in the 1840s. But the Jewish presence was to remain small in Marietta throughout the rest of the 19th century. Considerable pride was taken in the town's tree-lined streets. Ironically, here where once, not so very long past, giant trees had been the enemy, now stood what was acclaimed as the best shaded town in the state. Samuel Hildreth, despite keen competition from 17 physicians in Washington County, continued to monopolize the medical profession. Further, with the help of Ephraim Cutler and others of the old-timers, Hildreth, in 1848, published his long-awaited pioneer history on the early settlement of the Ohio Valley, a work like no other until then, and one of great lasting value. Praise for the book was plentiful, but that which had greatest meaning to Hildreth came from Benjamin Silliman, who wrote to tell him his name would be ever honorably associated with the early history of the West. In 1852, Hildreth followed with a second book, Memoirs of the Early Pioneer Settlers of Ohio, taking into account a cast of 39 characters of note. Ephraim lived on for 7 years after Sally's death, during which Julia remained a devoted companion and, greatly to her pleasure and her credit, he remained much as he had been in health and outlook. Pa spent a great deal of his time in his favorite occupation, she would write, reading his chosen books and the newspapers, never losing interest in what was happening in the world. One of the young teachers at Muskingum Academy had observed much the same thing. If he takes hold of a newspaper or an interesting book, everything else is sure to be neglected. He also enjoyed accompanying Julia on occasional days in Marietta, making calls and attending to some shopping. One such day they found time to visit Samuel Hildreth's fine garden and cabinet of geological specimens. The doctor's very excellent and highly cultivated taste is manifested in every part, Julia recorded. Thanksgiving, Ephraim's favorite day, remained no less a grand family festival. We did not intend to have any guests but our own family connections and those in the house, Julia recorded in her diary on Thursday, November 23, 1848. But the number who gathered was considerable all the same. 21 sat down to dinner. Pa expressed himself much pleased with the cooking of the turkey, chicken, pie, etc., and praised all the accompaniments, which was sufficient reward for all this labor of preparation, as we always consider this Pa's festival, which his Yankee origin has made him prize above all others. On his 83rd birthday, April 13, 1850, he rode by horseback 28 miles through snow and wind from Amesville back home. The farm, too, occupied his interest no less than ever. My health and strength has thus far sustained me in seeing every day to the hard work that is going on, he was glad to report to William in May. Be a farmer, his own father had strongly advised when Ephraim first started for the Ohio country. In the early spring of 1850, a shabby woman, no more than 5 feet tall, boarded a steamer at Cincinnati, where she had been living for 17 years, and departed upstream on the Ohio. She was happily heading home to New England, to Brunswick, Maine, where her husband had recently joined the faculty of Bowdoin College, and where, in the year ahead, she was to write her first book, titled Uncle Tom's Cabin, which would have more far-reaching effects than any American novel ever written. She herself, Harriet Beecher Stowe, would also achieve an overnight fame such as no American woman had yet known. The book, based largely on stories she had heard from black servants during her years in Cincinnati, was written from the heart and put slavery in terms of human beings and human suffering. Published in 1852, it was an immediate literary and political sensation, selling more than 300,000 copies in America within a year, and in England, no less than 1.5 million. It would be said Mrs. Stowe made more converts to anti-slavery with her book than all the preachers and lecturers combined. For those like Ephraim Cutler, who had labored so long and hard to keep slavery out of Ohio, she was a hero. Except for trouble hearing and the loss of some teeth. Ephraim remained remarkably his old self, still making the ride on horseback to his farm in Amesville. In the early spring of 1853, however, on a ride to Marietta, his horse stumbled and threw him to the ground. It had been a fall from a horse that long before took the life of his uncle Ephraim and so greatly changed the whole course of his boyhood. Now, still another fall from a horse would mark his own end. He died of internal injuries that summer at the Old Stone House on July 8, 1853. He was 86. In an eloquent funeral discourse, the Reverend E.B. Andrews, a professor at Marietta College, who also ministered in Ephraim's church in Warren, declared flatly Ohio had never been blessed with a truer statesman or more devoted servant, and gave praise particularly for his part in preventing the admission of slavery. We can hardly predict what the consequences would have been had there not been a few men such as Judge Cutler to resist the insidious aggressions of the monstrous evil of slavery. We owe it to the heroic Puritan firmness of Judge Cutler, and to him must ever belong the high honor of drafting that article in the first Constitution and fundamental law of the great state of Ohio, which makes it the home of the free while the state shall last. In a long tribute in the Marietta Intelligencer, he was credited as the first man in the state to propose anything like a system of common school instruction, and for never in all his years as a trustee of Ohio University missing a meeting of the board. In every sphere and every relation of life, Judge Cutler was a useful man. An editorial tribute in the Ohio State Journal would no doubt have pleased him most of all. Judge Cutler belonged to that class of strictly upright, honest, and true men, of whom the pioneers of this state afford so many noble examples. He was put to rest beside his wife, Sally, in the Gravel Bank Cemetery on a hill not far from the family home overlooking the Ohio River. By the time Samuel Hildreth lay dying 10 years later, the pioneer era he had taken part in and chronicled was long past. The population of Ohio had reached an unimaginable 2 million people and was still growing. Railroads and the telegraph had come of age. And overshadowing everything, the country was engulfed in a horrific civil war. In 1860, William Cutler was elected to Congress. In 1862, on April 23rd, he made a long and powerful speech on the floor of the House, denouncing slavery in no uncertain terms as a public enemy, and so must be destroyed. With notable vigor and courage, William had become the third generation of Cutlers to battle slavery. In the summer of 1863, when the war's biggest battle had only just been fought at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, on July 1st to 3rd, Ohio was suddenly in a state of alarm. A Confederate cavalry unit of more than 2,000 men, commanded by Brigadier General John Morgan, had crossed the Ohio River into Indiana, then crossed the line into Ohio, close to Cincinnati, and was advancing eastward, plundering everybody without fear or favor. The governor of Ohio had called out the militia. At Marietta, 10,000 or more were encamped, in the event Morgan might strike there in an attempt to escape back over the river. Another militia encampment had been established downriver at Warren, using the Cutler homestead as its command center. Militiamen were busy digging rifle pits across the field above the house. "We are getting accustomed to warlike sights and sounds," wrote Julia Cutler. "The glittering bayonets of the infantry, the bugle call of the artillery, the clanking of saber and carbine of the cavalry. They, the soldiers, come to us for food, medicines, tools, cooking utensils, tubs, washboard, soap, books, newspapers. Every shade tree has its group of loungers, reading, writing. Some walk about the garden. Some spend hours in the river, while others sleep their time away. All say they like this place better than any they have camped in. General Morgan and his men kept rapidly on the move until stopped at Buffington Island Ford on the Ohio River, nearly 60 miles downstream from Marietta, in a sharp skirmish with Ohio militia. More than 700 of his men were taken prisoner. Still, he moved on, turning north, crossing the Muskingum near McConnellsville, until finally stopped at Salineville, where he surrendered. At Camp Marietta, meantime, Dr. George Hildreth, who was serving with the militia there, had on July 20th suddenly requested a leave of absence to return to the family home on Putnam Street. Such was the declining condition of his father. The request was granted by his commander, Colonel William Rufus Putnam, Jr. Dr. Samuel Hildreth, now nearly 80, remained one of Marietta's most accomplished, highly respected citizens. He had been honored with numerous awards for worthy achievement well beyond Marietta, yet remained ever devoted to the town and the town to him. He had also remained in good health, a well-preserved and happy old gentleman, as said, until Sunday, July 5th. That morning he had attended church as usual, but in the afternoon he suffered a stroke that paralyzed him. Samuel Hildreth died on July 24th, 1863, in the grand red brick home built by Joseph Barker. His wife, Rhoda, his physician's son, George, and others of the family were at his side. His funeral was held 2 days later at the Congregational Church. He was buried beside his father at the Old Mound Cemetery. Rhoda Cook Hildreth, who died in 1868, would also be buried beside her husband. Published in the American Journal of Science and Arts a few months after Hildreth's death, Benjamin Silliman wrote, "In his private life, he illustrated every virtue of a Christian gentleman. Bright and cheerful by nature, he loved nature with the simple enthusiasm of a child. Industrious and systematic in a high degree, no moment of his life was wasted." A long obituary in the Marietta Register recounted Hildreth's many scientific and historic publications, that he had been president of the Medical Society of Ohio, that he had recently donated his collection of fossils, insects, and shells, some 4,000 specimens in natural history, arranged in cases and drawers, labeled, numbered, and entered in a catalog, to Marietta College. Besides his laborious medical practice, the obituary continued, he accomplished very much, as he himself expressed it, by saving the odds and ends of time. He was exact in all his dealings, an honest man, a Christian. His was a complete life. He finished his work. But then it can be said, too, that those others of the foremost pioneers of Marietta had finished their work, each in his or her way, and no matter the adversities to be faced, propelled as they were by high, worthy purpose, they accomplished what they had set out to do, not for money, not for possessions or fame, but to advance the quality and opportunities of life, to propel as best they could the American ideals.